My name is Simon Black. I'm a resident PhD student at the City Institute here at York. And it's my pleasure to introduce Heather Haynes and Peter Campbell to this week's City Seminar titled Shifting Empowerment, Remixing Values. Heather Haynes is the founder of the Toronto Free Gallery, a nonprofit art space dedicated to exhibiting works that deal with social, cultural, and urban issues. Along with her curatorial work, she is also an international programmer for Hot Docs International Documentary Film Festival, the Canadian producer for La Pocha Nostra, and the international producer for La Nostalgia Remix by James Luna and Guillermo Gomez Peña. She has produced three award-winning documentaries, Wetback, the undocumented documentary, Super Amigos, and City Idol. Heather maintains a passionate activism for social justice and environmental issues. She is specifically interested in urban and suburban social justice and environmental sustainability, and the role of arts and culture in fostering community engagement and change. Her commitment to these issues informs both her curatorial practice and documentary productions. Mark Campbell received his doctorate from the Department of Sociology and Equity Studies at OISE. Mark's current research interests involve Canadian hip-hop culture, Afro-diasporic cultures, Black Canada, Afrosonic theory, and community arts development. Mark is the founder of NorthsideHipHop.ca and the coordinator of TDOT Pioneers, a historical exhibit of Toronto hip-hop culture. So welcome, Mark and Heather.
Thank you. So I'm going to start, I guess. You have to excuse me. I was on tour recently, and I'm really kind of still adjusting to being back, even though it seems like it's been a week. But so if I space out, like, snap me back into reality, please. So, Toronto Free Gallery was started in 2004, and it's a not-for-profit art space that deals with social justice, cultural, environmental issues, sustainability, expressed through all media and arts. We also want to function as a creative laboratory that provides artists with the space to experiment, explore new ideas, question norms, and challenge themselves and their audiences. And our primary focus right now is to express these political ideas in a positive and constructive way, to provide a space that gives equal exhibition opportunities and space to diverse racial and cultural communities, and to maintain a space where artists, architects, and socially conscious organizations can present work in a meaningful way. So we don't always work with known artists. We'll work with social justice organizations who will present projects mixed in with artists and what have you. And we also focus a lot on supporting the work of young and emerging artists. And when the gallery first started, it was in 2004, and our opening exhibition was called Project Toronto, which was dealing with the issues in the urban landscape of our city. And at the same time, there was this kind of wave of urban activism that started. And we started to work with these different organizations because we had similar ideas and goals. But after a while, a lot of these organizations were not, I felt, being very inclusive for the diversity that exists within the city, and not dealing with issues such as poverty, access and equity to transportation, youth issues, race issues within the city, and the work focused very much on kind of public space and play in the city. So, on many different levels, it was a very kind of middle class movement that was not representative of Toronto. And Toronto Free started to become a gallery that was being known for dealing a lot with issues in the city, and so it was important for me to kind of shift and expand that dialogue. So I started to do research on different organizations that I could bring in to collaborate with that would address these issues. And through this, I met Mark, and he proposed TDOT Pioneer Show, which after we put on, through Mark as well, I made a lot of connections with organizations that I'm working with now, like Black Daddies, which is a support network for fathers, and Breaking the Cycle, which is a group that works with kids exiting gangs, and we have a youth project now that we're working on. And so this kind of work, for me, is much more representative of like an urban activism and an urban dialogue that needs to occur. Right now, also in Toronto, I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, and in the arts community there, you see more diversity reflected in the art spaces that exist, and there's more collaboration and conversation that happens, and I feel that at least within the downtown core of Toronto, you don't have that quite as much. The art scene is pretty white, and I've been speaking with a lot of artists and curators that feel that they don't have access to these spaces, and so this is something that we're really taking on full power at Toronto Free, and we've started some of our programming has been focusing primarily on these issues, and so this is an exhibition that we did, I think it was in 2008, with Emery Douglas, who was the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. And this is a group called The Pinky Show, and they're a collective out of Hawaii, and their work focuses on stolen land from indigenous groups around the world. We work a lot with Mayworks, and this is an exhibition of Fabiana Rodriguez, who is a Chicana artist coming out of Oakland. And her work deals a lot with Chicano issues, women, and labor. And I have no idea what that is. I think we're missing. Well, this was supposed to be the T-Dot. Slide.
Scroll down. I think the image is.
Is it down?
Or to the right. Your image is just huge. There it is.
There it is. Okay. Well, Mark will have a lot of images from T-Dot Pioneers, but that's where this is supposed to be. This is Guillermo Gomez Peña and his performance group La Pocha Nostra, and I love the way he kind of frames this. A lot of his work, he deals with tackling lazy thinking about ethnicity and culture. And that was back in 2004. This is Sandasa Abdul Hadi, again with Mayworks, and her exhibition, it was a painting exhibition that focused on shifting negative stereotypes of Muslims. And then, with all this kind of programming, one of the big questions that all arts organizations have is how do you bring in the audiences to see and engage with this work? And we worked with an artist named Sarah Febraro, who does these neighborhood talk shows, where she went out into the community and literally like knocked on people's doors and met with people in businesses and what have you, and tried to get their stories of where they've come from, what their lives are like, and so they came in and she interviewed them, and they did talks, or it was kind of like a talk and a talent show. And then Georgina down here, who runs the Caribbean Patty Queen next door, she cooked curry stew for like 150 people, and then there was a DJ afterwards, and everyone danced and kind of hung out, and it was amazing because we had a lot of we have a lot of dealers that live in the neighborhood, and they grew up in the neighborhood, and so they do have strong connections and ties. There's a women's shelter that is also there, and it's a women's shelter that supports women that are dealing with some of the hardest mental. Sorry, I'm fading. So the mental health issues, it's pretty intense, and This neighborhood is going through a lot of gentrification right now, and there's a great deal of concern in how these people are going to have kind of the support systems and networks that they need to have. And so I really try to make Toronto Free a space that is very welcoming and inviting, where people can come in and they feel comfortable. And so this is actually a project that we would like to continue with on a monthly basis, but it's just a matter of kind of finding some funding to get that going. And then, and you know, we also work with high school students, and this is the student school, and we supported their graduation exhibition. And you know, this kind of work is important to us to give these kids inspiration for what you know they're doing, and show support for their work and honor the work that they are doing. And so we continue to work with high schools like this to do graduation shows. And then we also hosted Breaking the Cycle, their graduation ceremony for the kids that are exiting gangs, and they had artwork displayed and what have you. And we're continuing to work with them in a youth project that we're developing. And then we also do a lot of talks dealing with various political issues, and this one was organized by Heather McLean and her group Creative Class Struggle, and this was called Demystifying Creative Cities. And we had so many people there that we had to like break it up into two different sections, so we simulcast in one room and had the actual talk in the main space. So with that, you know, we're trying to really kind of shift the audiences and make the space very accessible and available, and we want people to feel comfortable, like they can be a part of this and not, you know, oftentimes you walk into very pristine galleries and it's intimidating. It's not a comfortable public space, and sometimes the work is not accessible. So this is a big focus. How do we shift this? How do we change this? How do we open ourselves up? And in doing this, it's, from my perspective, I've been working with all of these different groups, like the South Asian Visual Arts Collective, the Latino Canadian Cultural Association, Northside Hip Hop. And one thing that I've been noticing is there are these kind of cultural silos that exist. So if we have an exhibition with the South Asian Visual Arts Center, 90% of the people that will be at that exhibition are South Asian. If you do something on urban activism, probably 90% of the people will be white, middle-class people that will come to that. And from my perspective, I get to work with all these people personally and professionally, get to understand their politics, what their goals and their visions are, and there's so many affinities that exist between these groups, and I'm really interested now to try to see how we can create a collaboration or a conversation that happens amongst everyone. And so we're putting programming into place to kind of deal with this issue. One of them is, it's called The Bridge, which is going to be a monthly speaker series in the format of a sit-down dinner. So we have tables laid out like this. We have enough space for 40 people. I cook a meal for everybody. And we discuss, we have a conversation about gaps in racial, social, and economic inequality and equal representation. And the last one we had was amazing. People came at 7 and they stayed till 1 o'clock in the morning just sitting and talking. And there's something about having these kinds of discussions around food that makes people open up and really want to share. And people that may not feel comfortable normally talking, they speak. And so the conversations have been really great, and one of the talks that we're going to have coming up is with Wanda Nanabush, who is a curator of contemporary Aboriginal work, and we've been talking a lot about these silos that exist and how can we start to really bring forward these affinities. So she'll be doing a talk on that, and then another talk will be Steve Loft, who He's Mohawk of the Six Nations, and he's a writer and curator who also does contemporary Aboriginal work, but primarily in new media. And we're kind of trying to figure out a title for the talk, but he definitely wants to address the whiteness in the cultural scene in the downtown core and what it is like to curate and show within this kind of landscape. And then another project that we're putting forward is with Saul Garcia Lopez, and he's up here at York University in the theater studies program. He also tours with Guillermo Gomez Peña and La Cocha Nostra, the slide that you saw before. And we're interested in putting a curatorial laboratory together, which will be part brainstorming session and part performance lab, where we bring together people of different cultural backgrounds who will begin to directly address the issues around lack of space and access to these city cultural institutions. And then we've also really been working with La Cocha Nostra. And this is James Luna at the top and Guillermo Gomez Peña. This show is La Nostalgia, which is the one that they're touring now. And you know, they work a lot in unveiling through parody various colonial practices that exist within cultural institutions. And so this is the performance laboratory that we're going to be doing is very much inspired by the work that they're also doing. So, I mean, these are kinds of the things that we are trying to address at Toronto Free, and some of the projects and ways that we're trying to kind of reshift and remix what's going on. So, and then Mark, I guess, is going to speak more specifically about the TDOT Pioneers, which was shown last year at Toronto Free. No, should we take questions now or just go into?
To the end?
It doesn't matter. I mean, if anyone has, you know, a question now.
Any questions this far?
So, TDOT Pioneers originally happened at Toronto Free Gallery in 2010, March 4th until April 17th last year. And I'll sort of go into a little bit about the intention behind it and sort of the history. TDOT Pioneers is interesting because, and I'm just getting over a cold right now, so I might not be able to speak for as long as I can, and I don't normally sound like this. TDOT Pioneers started out as an idea that I got from giving a lecture in the geography department here, and I was lecturing on this the spatial politics of Canadian, or the spatial politics of Toronto hip-hop, right? And it was really about the ways in which different groups take up space under sort of the hip-hop mantra of representation, right? And what I had realized on one of my records, I found this logo, and I found it interesting because I was also speaking on sort of the origins of the word TDOT and how it sort of arose out of the hip-hop community in the mid-90s. And what I discovered is, you know, this logo, and for the people, I contacted the people that sort of put this record together, which was Knee Deep Records. That's why, I spoke to them, and I was kind of like, so what's this logo thing all about? Because there was never a record or a song by that title. There was nothing further than just this logo. And it got me thinking in terms of, you know, their feedback was really like, you know, we thought we were just doing something new and groundbreaking, etc. Right. So I utilized this moniker and this logo to create TDOT Pioneers, the exhibition. And the idea really came from me being unable to, I was writing a chapter for one of the new Black History textbooks in high school, and I was doing the Canada post 1965 or something like that. And I wanted to include something on hip hop, and finding that there were no resources available to me, no written resources. So I started to do the work myself. And having an older brother that was in the industry, I started to learn a little bit about sort of his life and his work as a DJ for the last 25 years in Toronto. And I came upon a whole bunch of sort of important information that nobody knew besides whoever embodied it, and it was written nowhere. And then I found a way to include that into the textbook that was being produced at the time. So I pushed on with this project thinking, there's a lot of history here. My MA is in history, so I had, you know, a somewhat familiarity with the discipline, and I thought I should spend time to develop an exhibit that would showcase, you know, historical artifacts from Toronto hip-hop, because the DJs don't necessarily know what the B-boys have done, and the B-boys don't necessarily know what the MCs have done, but it's supposed to be this kind of culture. So moving along with this idea of T-Dot Pioneers, I was thinking there's lots more groundbreaking work to do. And then the idea was to create a forum where the young people that are reading that textbook could also experience some of these things. So when we put on T-Dot Pioneers, a lot of my teacher friends brought their students down, and we did little workshops and activities within the gallery, so that there was a way that the textbook material could come alive, right? So T-Dot Pioneers, then the whole idea, once we started developing it, and it took more than a year to source out a lot of the artifacts and speak to people and document oral history. The idea was to create something where in which I could not be the sole sort of all-knowing curator, right? Not embody that kind of position, a hegemonic position. So the idea that we came up with was to make it a participatory exhibit. So it wasn't up to me to get all of the materials, put it on the wall, narrate it, and write a wonderful brochure. But the idea was to have the actual participants from the culture to come into the gallery space, take over the gallery space, put their item, what they thought was important to them, on the wall in the gallery, and then narrate that item. So that I ended up being coordinating all of that, and the power then of the curator was dispersed amongst the individuals, thus empowering them to think differently about their contribution to quote-unquote the creative city or the creative process. Because when we look around at other institutions in Toronto now, you could look at the brochure for the Toronto Public Library and they're talking about the T-Dot. You could look at other institutions and somehow these words and the creative energies of these people that are more times than not on the periphery of society, these words are now being used by commentators and hosts in different kinds of places without any actual knowledge of the people that created them. Right, and the circumstances under which these things were created are unknown and for most part are not part of the equation. It's not honored in any kind of way, and this was an attempt to honor that. So what I did was a lot of people had flyers from events, and the flyers were sort of that one physical document, if we were to be very very disciplinary about it. It was a historical artifact or a document, a primary source document. And a lot of what I found with a lot of these flyers was the key names and individuals of the people that were involved, the locations of where things happened. I mean, this is something really interesting. This is the whole idea of Scarborough style, right? Back in the 80s, and the whole idea of having Crush Groove was the name of a famous hip-hop film, right? And you have LL Cool J here. So I went through all of these flyers, sort of just gathering information of where were things happening, who were the DJs that were involved, you know, St. Lawrence Church, is that still around, etc., right? Doing that kind of work. So the flyers then became one part of what was in the exhibit. The other things that were in the exhibit, this is an award from... This radio show is the longest running radio hip-hop radio show, continuous running hip-hop radio show in Canada. And this year will be its 22nd year, right? And one of the interesting things about this plaque, and when we talked about it in the exhibit, was that if you see the Sony Music, Universal, BMG, Warner, and Virgin presented this plaque to a college radio station, and there was this intimate connection between the mixtapes and the promotional work that DJs were doing, that made the success of these record labels possible. And it's one of those things where it had to be in the exhibit, because when we think of the colossal failure of the record industry now, there's this huge disconnection between what the record label became and its origins in terms of working collaboratively with college radio stations and college radio hip-hop shows. So I have a show here at CHRY that I've had for the last 13 years. And prior to sort of the internet and the peer-to-peer trading, the record labels would call us every week and give us records to promo, get our feedback, and ask us sort of what we want, where we're playing them, etc. And these are the intangibles that get lost in the historical narrative, right, of the creativity and actually the importance of the hip-hop industry, right? So this was one of the plaques that were in there. The other thing that we did for opening night is we brought from New York this guy named K-Force, and he's on the far left there. And what's interesting, he's the man that's credited with coming up with the term T-Dot, right? And it was sort of part of his rhymes. He came out one day in his rhymes, and he's one of the most well-respected individuals in the hip-hop genre in Toronto. So we flew him up from New York, and he gave a little talk, so it was like a coming home party. But the whole idea of that was, because we had so much media and we had so much attention, was to not just set the record straight, but to give value or honor value where it actually exists, right? So when we talk about remixing values, people started to think more differently about hip-hop culture. So when I'm calling people, I'm saying, hey, do you have old flyers, do you have old cassettes, rah, rah, rah. I'm going to put it in the exhibit. They're like, what? There's a gallery in Toronto that would want to hang our stuff? What do you mean? You can't be serious, right? So it was that kind of feeling like what we did is not necessarily worth anything. So why would a gallery want it? And that was the empowerment piece, right? Some of the things, this is a little fuzzy, some of the things that came out of this sort of on-the-ground research, this is a dub plate that came out of King Jammy's studio, and King Jammy was one of the last greatest producers to come out of Jamaica. And the guy that created this song, he's from Toronto, his name is Rumble. And he had a record deal back in, this record is from 91, it's a 7-inch dub plate. And a dub plate, for anyone that's not familiar, is within the dancehall tradition, when an artist creates a song that they want to promo to the crowd, they'll create the song in the daytime. In the evening, they'll play that song in the dance hall and gather the feedback immediately. King Jammy actually liked this track so much that he created a 7-inch dub play, played it in the dance that night, and one of the songs got such great feedback that was the song that got him signed to his label in London. So he became one of the, in the 90s, he became one of the first signees, I guess after Maestro and Mishi, to have an international record label. And it was interesting because those diaspora connections, he's of Jamaican heritage, but the way in which the dance hall and the sound system, its importance is connected to Toronto and it connected back to London. It's an interesting commentary on the triangle of trade. Like if you were to go back into the Atlantic slave trade and to think very, very non-regional, very diasporic, to think about the music in that way, because there are many other artists in Toronto that brought the Caribbean connection with them into their music. And so Mishimi would have been also recording in Jamaica at the time, in the early 90s. It's interesting because one of the Mishimi records that I had on display in the exhibit, I made sure we displayed the back of the record, because singing backup for her in 1989 was Shabba Ranks and Patra, which became these huge superstars in the 90s, but just to signify sort of her importance at that moment. And the person that produced her was Junior Reed, who is now a huge reggae star. But it sort of gave us a different idea of the importance and the value of the music and the creative process outside of the Toronto landscape, where it wasn't necessarily known. Radios were not playing this music in Toronto. There was no interest in black music at all at the time. So that was, I think, this is some of the things that came out of the research, that I wanted to share. The title of today's talk, Shifting Empowerment, Remixing Values. This is part of what you would have seen at the exhibit. There's a timeline, which is, that's the subway line playing on this whole sort of underground idea. And right below this gold record is Ivan Berry's, has a handwritten note. Ivan Berry was a record label, one of the first record label execs, owners, I should say, that signed Mishimi and signed the, put out records from all those stars that we know. That gold record is from Ice-T's record, Power. And he was a tour manager when Ice-T was touring Canada in the 80s or whatever. And just bringing these pieces out and allowing other people in the hip-hop community to see these are the kinds of things that were happening in the 80s was a good educational moment for, you know, a b-boy from 98 or 2005 or whatever. But it also allowed other DJs and other people in the industry to gain a little bit of pride in terms of the accomplishments. So I had here visual plus meaning equals value, right? People, when they saw these things on the wall and the gallery space, they were able to extract a different kind of meaning from the things that they've been part of, the accomplishments of hip-hop culture. And that in turn allowed for a different kind of value to be assessed, right? To look at all of the accomplishments in the room and understand that the hip-hop community is not necessarily a community of just an entertainment-driven, right? It's a bunch of people that whose creative capacities enhance and make their city better, right? And that was, this is just another snapshot of a whole bunch of different items that we were able to have on display, right? So the participatory part of the exhibit that I was mentioning, we actually had people tag the timeline, right, in this very sort of hip-hop sense where this person's writing about, you know, a record he recorded when he was a teenager, that, you know, it was, you know, it had been an anthem for Toronto hip-hop for a good decade and a half, and some people argue still is. So a lot of these people, like me and him, went to elementary school and high school, and we both went to York here together, and the idea was this, to have these people narrate that timeline, because he lived it, and I'm not there to tell or demonstrate, you know, how astute my knowledge is of hip-hop culture. It was more about empowering these individuals to tell their story, right? And then to understand that what you do is important, and it enhances not just your life, but the cultural life of the city, right? So we turn to this year, and this is something that's happening right now. I was asked to do to remount the exhibit at the CBC. So I'll rewind a little bit. Part of the participatory nature of the exhibit meant that people came in off of the street with their records. And they said, "This is a record I made. Can you put it on the wall?" And I have all these other images, you know, and that for that. That sense alone was so powerful that one person had a record out from 87. He brought it in. He works at the CBC and he's a producer. And he said he witnessed all of the exhibit. He's like, "Wow, this is powerful. I could do something like this at CBC because they have a lot more money." So he roped me in, and we came up with this thing called the Hip Hop Summit. And it's like a week long sort of festival. It's a day. Today is most of the activities. On Tuesday night we had taping of, you know, we brought all of the legendary hip-hop folks out, and they performed, and we have this exhibit remounted there, but it's a little bit different this year. That's it down there, T-Dot Pioneers 2011, the Glenn Gould remix. The idea this year now is to take over the Glenn Gould studio and intertwine Toronto hip-hop history with some of the artifacts that they have in there. In the Glenn Gould studio, and I have some of the booklets, but if you go through the booklet in the catalog, it will explain a little bit more sort of the rationale. But the idea now is to demonstrate the way in which we changed the values of that institution. So this idea started in May of last year, and this exhibit closed on April 17th. So we've been having this conversation for a long time, and there was a lot of pushing and tugging and fighting, but the idea was CBC has never, ever supported Toronto or Canadian hip-hop in any kind of way. They've aired two or three concerts from K-Non or Chaos or whoever they chose that they thought was worthy of their audience. And this year they've put a significant amount of time and money behind putting together an entire summit. And the idea now is sitting at the table, sort of talking to the directors and not just convincing them, but demonstrating to them how they can expand their audience base. They jumped on board with this. And I think that's probably the biggest shift that we can see on the institutional level, where VPs and directors at CBC are coming out. And Dwight Drummond, you know, the latest sort of CBC person that's being touted around, is in the audience and singing to the songs and whatever. And you'll see him in that video, which they're airing today. And then this is the flyer for the exhibit today, which was mounted back on Tuesday when we did the opening. So the whole idea is just to take this honoring our ancestors, right, in hip-hop culture, and moving it throughout different institutions and forcing people to sort of reconcile the creative value that, you know, oftentimes marginalized hip-hop populations provide and bring to the city and to other institutions. So I'll stop there so we can take some questions.
And I just want to say that it was amazing because I was sitting in the gallery the whole time this exhibition was up, and there would be like, you know, a dad coming in with his child, and the child would be like, oh my God, you know, that's my auntie or my uncle, and, you know, or I know that person, they came over to my house, and there was this history that the kids were getting, and they were just so excited to be able to make these connections, and that was great.
And listen to cassettes, we had some.
Yeah.
I bought a whole bunch of old Bachmans and had these little kids listen to the actual cassette and rewind it and ask what it is, and, you know, and being involved in that part of it was, for their parents, it made their parents proud to be able to say, you know, this is me rapping on this or whatever.
Yeah. I'm astounded to hear you talk about this hip-hop summit, because I'm, you know, much to the chagrin of everybody I know, I listen to Radio 2 all the time, and we've made a lot of the hip-hop summit, and the narrative that you have given of this is completely different than the narrative that I've been hearing on Radio 2, and I never even knew that this was happening from what I heard. I thought it was just a concert, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting that this... We have different kinds of narratives around this particular activity that circulate in the city. And if you are in one network of that narrative, you will never know anything else about what's going on except what the narrative of that network tells you. So I just wanted to say that because I find this absolutely astounding. I'm wondering if the exhibition, is that still up, or was it just up for the moment of the concert?
No, it's up. Yeah, it's up until I'm taking it down on Sunday.
Okay.
So it's the reception is actually tonight at 5, where we'll just take people around and talk a little bit about it.
At the Glenn Gould Studio.
Yeah, at the Glenn Gould Studio. And there's also panel discussions happening in there. One thing I didn't mention, part of the 6-week exhibit at Toronto Free is we had two panel discussions, I think. Two or three panel discussions.
And two concerts.
And two concerts. And we brought out like hundreds of people, and that's kind of what we, you know, Hip Hop Summit is trying to replicate in terms of, I told them, like I sat on the steering committee and I said, if we're going to do this, we need to speak about culture and not just industry, right? Because as the industry dies, the culture is not dying, right? And people try to talk about hip hop is dead, etc. But further to your point, Warren, I think if the typical CBC Radio 2 listener was hearing something about a hip-hop exhibit, that might rub them the right. I would imagine people would question that and be like, what? What do you mean a hip-hop exhibit? What is T-Dot Pioneers? That, to me, that narrative can't fit with that audience. And I understand and sort of appreciate that, because when they asked me to do it, I said, you know, CBC listeners don't care about Toronto hip-hop culture, you know what I mean? But I said to them, I think what's important is that the people that supported this exhibit last year, Toronto Free, should need to see this in the CBC, and see that kind of institutional commitment or change or support, right? And I couldn't imagine, on the radio, I don't think they really promoted it. Like, they promoted it a little bit in the flyer, but it's really been on me to sort of, all of the promotion has been around the concert.
Well, no, I mean, there's been a lot on CBC about the music, but not this element and not the entire picture. And I was talking, I had a meeting with someone in the community this morning. We were talking about this, and I was saying to them that it's so interesting that, CBC is hosting the Hip Hop Summit. I found this kind of interesting. But where have the hip hop community been to take CBC to put on a summit? And this person was saying to me, well, you know, the community really doesn't think of the hip hop that is in the CBC Hip Hop Summit as hip hop. The kids don't really think of this as hip hop. This is more palatable for a CBC audience because they play Kanon and Chaos, and they play a significant amount of hip hop. And one of the DJs on CBC considers himself to be a hip hop artist, Buck 65.
Yeah.
And if one were to listen to the CBC, one would think that Buck 65 was the actual promoter of the Hip Hop Summit. So I'm just fascinated by the what I'm hearing today, because it's like it's such a shock to my system, because I, you know, here I am, I'm so enthralled in the CBC's discourse, and now you burst the bubble. I feel like I don't know anything anymore. So I'm going to come down there tonight. I mean, this is quite fantastic.
I mean, Buck 65 is one of the, sort of the original cats out of Halifax, right? So in the late 80s, he's had like 15 or 16 albums. But the CBC scooped him up, I think, in their attempt to try and reach my demographic, right?
That's right.
Knowing that he was irrelevant, really, in Toronto at that stage in his career. But with the interesting part, I think how this really happened is that a lot of employees in CBC were hip-hoppers. You know what I mean? So When they tout Dwight Drummond as sort of their new person, Dwight Drummond is in the video for Let Your Backbone Slide. He was there. He was at all the parties, and you know, he was in the audience at the concert on Tuesday. And I think that was one way to sort of convince the older heads at CBC, like, you can't really run away from this because you're one of their biggest producers that records all their concerts on the road. He's the cat that came to TDOT Pioneers and is like, you know, I've been doing this since 84. And he has an independent production studio, etc. So a lot of what they're finding, and I'm sure other organizations are finding, that in their institutions, they're finding people that have long hip-hop histories that are not necessarily willing to let them go.
Well, in some ways, I can't really believe this is so. I mean, we even have to talk about this still after like 25 years or 30 years of this art form to be around, and it still sort of hasn't broken that perforated the fairly accessible public radio thing. We're not talking about, you know, more restrictive forms of communication. We're talking about a public broadcast, and this is still going on. But I think one of the things for me, the two things I want us to ask about. One is relates to the question of generation, which is, I mean, I remember distinctly the moment, the place where I heard Matt Galloway, when he moved to the afternoon show, introducing Chaos's first or second album in the afternoon show and saying, this is the best album of this year. And that was maybe 5 years ago when he moved to the afternoon show. And so I went out and the next day and I bought the album. And it occurred to me now that when you were talking, that of course, the fact that I remember this and the fact that I noticed at the time, that this is an interesting moment, is the fact that before Matt Galloway was even on both the afternoon show or now in the morning show, all you heard was people with fiddles on the CBC. It's only 5 years ago that something else was going to be played in the morning. It was either fiddles or it was Latin American, some Latin mix thing. So it was. I called that actually the CBC music, when it had a fiddle in it or when it sort of was Latin. It was CBC music to me. So it is only a very recent development. So now, of course, he played Chaos, and who now is, and even then probably was more established, but now is very established. And of course, I have no connection as a CBC listener to anything that the kids might hear, right? I mean, there's a generation gap that is, I can't even, there's no way to bridge that because I'm not tied into the communication networks that would bring that to me. So that's the one thing. So the generation thing, I'd like to hear a little bit more about, and where the real hip-hop now is. Are there spaces in the city where that's being produced, and who are the people who are the space? The second thing, just an observation, is that I lived in the late 80s, I lived in Los Angeles, and I listened to hip-hop, and I even wrote about hip-hop, and I then moved to Frankfurt in Germany, and from Frankfurt in 91 I moved here. And when I moved here, I had an interest in hip-hop, and I was listening to hip-hop, and I had no problems finding hip-hop. And I, in fact, re-imported, I for a while brought Canadian hip-hop CDs to friends in Germany because I thought they didn't have that. And I remember maybe 91, 92, 93, I bought a record that I had heard about on some, maybe it was a college radio station, I don't remember, it's 20 years ago. And it maybe was Dream Warriors album or I just don't remember what CD it was. But it took me a long time. I went from record store to record store on Yonge Street to find that record, that CD. And I finally found it. And I gave it to my friend, who was a hip-hop fan in Frankfurt. And I was so proud of myself. And then I walked into a drugstore in Zurich 2 days later. And it was at the checkout counter.
That's interesting.
So this was a Toronto product. It was a Toronto artist. And I couldn't find that CD in Toronto on Yonge Street, where I should have found it. And I walked into a drugstore in Zurich and I found it. So there was something which was, in the industry at that time, was already completely globalized. You could actually hear Canadian hip-hop in Germany on the radio, but in Toronto, you could neither find the CDs nor could you hear it on the radio. So that completely has always puzzled me. So I don't know where to go with this, but it seems to be something despatialized there, non-spatialized, that has to do with the institutionalization of the record industry, which, as you say, is now dying. I know what that means. But to me, this is now a surprise that you talk about this in this way, because for me, as a newcomer to Toronto 20 years ago, hip-hop was always there. And I'm not really the demographic. Then I was not the demographic who would have seen that right away. So it puzzles me a little bit.
One of the interesting parts of the exhibit that's up tonight is a photographer. I commissioned a photographer to do a series of images, and one of the themes this year is on space. Looking at how hip-hop culture developed and continues to maintain itself through space. So the photographer goes to different sites where these huge concerts that are like all in the flyers or whatever, where they took place. So there's a series of 7 photos of different spaces of where hip-hop community was nurtured. So it's interesting that you asked the question about space. I'm pretty sure the CD that you saw in Zurich would have been Dream Warriors. Because they sold 100,000 units in Europe, and they didn't even sell a quarter of that in Canada. And a lot of that has to do with the record industry, but not just the record industry, because the record industry, it's 2011, and the Junos thought they could not air the Rap Award this year, although a rapper was hosting the event, right? So there's no other sort of discussion necessary, right? We just need to look at the Junos and the kind of support that the artists get in this city, right? And it's not just hip-hop, right? Like, art in and of itself barely gets support across the board. But you add a different element where this art might be conceived as crude or borderline or aggressive or whatever you want to call it. You can call it urban, you know, if you so choose. But so despatialized. I think there's active efforts to erase, right? And this is why when CBC sort of, they did their whole sort of media run, and they told the Globe and Mail and they told National Post Munch Music, and you know, do you want to come? People were laughing, like, really, hip-hop is at the CBC? What do you mean by that? This must be a joke, right? Because people just know that the major institutions in the city and in the country do not support hip-hop culture, period, right? So drugstore in Zurich supports Toronto hip-hop more than a drugstore in Toronto, clearly. In terms of generations, interesting you mentioned Matt Galloway, because Matt Galloway and the producer of the show, Nikki Davis, we were all in the last York Alumni Mag. All of us, all of these people are inside the CBC. So every time a director might turn around and say, hip-hop? No, really? Why? You have someone like Matt Galloway, who interviewed me last year, saying, this is great work, I'm so glad you're doing this. Then you have someone like Nikki Davis saying, choosing the interview, saying, you know, these things are important. Nikki Davis gave me flyers from when he was a DJ in hip-hop in 82 and 83. And then you have people like Garvey Bailey, Chris Jacks. I could continuously name the name. So there's work that a generation is doing to sort of, and I'm sort of part of that older generation, to ensure that the information is trickles down. Because if you were to, surprisingly enough, if you were to Google Toronto hip-hop history before the exhibit last year, you wouldn't find anything. There was nothing. In a world of 6 billion pages of information, there was nothing. But if you Google today, you'll find all kinds of videos where people are actually referring to hip-hop artists as pioneers, right? Which I do sort of regularly when I'm feeling down or something like that. I'll just Google that, and then you can see sort of the effect in which a new generation can speak. They have the language to speak of older hip-hop culture.
Did you, for the CBC show, did you guys get coverage from Globe and Mail and Toronto
Not
Star?
The exhibit.
And,
no. No. The coverage has all been for the concert.
Well, I wonder what that says about, so, I mean, I was going back to that point I was going to ask about. Going back to something Heather said, I was very interested in, you know, this problematic of the mainstream institutions and artist-run institutions and the question of accessible work and inaccessible work. I'm wondering how that applies to something like TDOT. I mean, to whom is it accessible and to whom is it inaccessible? Again, I'm just referring to this discussion I was having with this person just this morning. I'm so amazed, because we were just talking this morning about the summit. And one of the arguments this person was making to me is that, well, the kind of hip-hop that the CBC is pushing is really very much in line with Radio 2, because Radio 2 is very much pushing a certain kind of Canadian independent singer-songwriter. And so the hip-hop artists that are promoted by the CBC are really in that kind of genre. They sort of understand them as independent singer-songwriters. Like, they are writing these things and they're performing them, and they are relatively independent. And the other argument that this person was making to me this morning was that, you know, kids really prefer the American music to Canadian music, and this seems to align with what the CBC in fact says, that there's a big deal about how different Canadian hip-hop is, and has always been, from its American cousins. So I'm just wondering what you have to say about the question of accessibility and inaccessibility with respect both to the questions of the music and also questions of its exhibition as well. Because I see one of the images that you showed of the exhibition itself looked very self-conscious to me. That's the way I think it was, just random. Kind of brick wall, some brick structure. It looked like a design. And I would not think that was an unself-conscious installation.
Which image was that? Was that Mark's?
It was the exhibition shot. It was like a wall, sort of an angle. Yeah, this one.
Oh, okay.
this looks curated to me.
Do you want to speak about the curatorial part of that?
Yeah,
I mean, because
like
that's more. You, okay. I mean, there's. You made a few points, and one of them I want to talk about what I hear a lot happening within the arts community. I'm not from Canada. I grew up in the States, and in the States, like, you know, you have a singer, an artist, whatever, and I mean, Americans are full of themselves, right? It's like, oh, the greatest, blah 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 blah, and here. It's like, yeah, and I have some ideas. I can't really speak to why this happens, but the Torontonians, at least, I haven't lived in other parts of Canada, but Torontonians do not honor their own. And so many artists have to leave Canada to get recognition, and then the galleries are like, oh, you showed in New York, okay, you can come back, now you're a real artist, right? And so that's a huge, huge problem, and I think that, you know, relates a bit to what you were saying. And I mean, in terms of sorry, you're gonna have to snap me back. I'm going slow moving.
To the accessibility, inaccessibility.
Yep.
What makes something accessible and what makes it inaccessible, even within the Toronto Free Gallery?
In terms of, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we show is, we put a lot of description around the work, so people can come in and they can read about what is happening. I'm there, so I will also walk out and actually talk to people and take people around and explain what's going on. I think the kind of work that we curate, people can relate to in their lives. It's not super abstract, conceptual work. So there is an accessibility in terms of how people are connecting to the work. And it's not just private or public galleries. It's also artist-run centers that are kind of curating a lot of stuff that I think speaks to a very specific art crowd. And that art crowd has been, you know, highly educated. It's a language that just, it exists right there. And while, you know, I think, you know, sometimes that's important, I think, you know, those kinds of spaces need to open up. It would be nice if they had a little more responsibility to explain the work and engage with the public. And they always talk about engaging with the public, but oftentimes people feel intimidated by walking into the space at all. You know, you walk in, you're not greeted, people don't say hello. I mean, they're just like really basic, you know, things. You walk in and, you know, there is, you know, a curator that looks down on you like you're dirty or something. And, you know, you feel really uncomfortable walking in. So, I mean, for me, you know, I mean, this high conceptual work, it's very interesting. The ideas are very interesting. But if you're not trained in this language, it would be nice if the people working in the gallery would take the responsibility, engagement, to take people around. It's not like, you know, galleries have thousands of people walking through them. There's like maybe 3 a day on a weekday. Like, you can take the time and do it. It's not that hard, you know? So I don't know if that answers.
No, but I made a number of suggestions about engagement. I like this supper idea, supper conversation, dinner conversation, and the different kinds of ways you're trying to move people across the different silos that seem to line up with different kinds of projects. And I think that's very difficult.
It's extremely difficult. You know, and I keep trying to talk to all these organizations and bring this conversation up, and people's faces are lighting up to it, and they're like, you're right, this exists, and, you know, like, you know, somehow we do have to, you know, start to have, you know, these conversations and not be afraid to talk about this kind of stuff. And the dinner works. It's amazing. And when Georgina cooked, like, that pot of stew, it's like, it's huge. And we had DJs, and it was just like, it was so lovely, and everyone, you know, was kind of hanging out. It's
so
good.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about this, because this looks like Mark was saying that this was more consistent. But how did this design actually come about?
Well,
is this participatory, or is this curator having to, at the end of the day, having to make some decisions about the nature of the installation itself?
Well, Mark Mark was the curator, but I will tell you, it was highly participatory because, you know, if Mark wouldn't be there, someone would come and drop something off, and we were constantly hanging stuff on the wall. Like, it just kept growing and growing and growing and growing. So, you know, Mark spent a lot of time collecting this work, and then, you know, he came up with this the subway line, and that was kind of really... You know, we hung up what you had, and then people just kept filling in and filling in, and we had to move things and cover holes and repaint and add and grow. So,
yeah. Yeah, there was I think right before we opened the exhibition, all the stuff that's inside that case was brought in by DJ Grouch with a baby stroller, and he helped to sort of put it all together because I wasn't there at the time. But a lot of the things, like behind that brick wall, there were things that just kept coming in. So accessibility-wise, people knew what was going up because they were putting it up. And then where I could get people to actually write on the timeline or write on a cue card, right? They were narrating the things that were there, and sometimes they weren't. You know, there was nothing super highly sophisticated about what they were writing. I remember when I went on tour, like, so for example, there's a record on that side of the wall where one of the few ladies that were participating, Tara Chase, said, I remember going on tour with Shaw Claire and these guys, you know, and that was the first time I had to learn to fart out loud amongst all these men. And it's like, that's... To me, that was hilarious, but that's part of the story that will never get told. Like, a woman traveling in this whole sort of very masculine hip-hop culture, and this is what comes out of it. You know, like, she didn't say, I learned to be rough and tough kind of thing. I just learned to be gross like the rest of the guys kind of thing. So I think that's the beauty of what came out of it.
And you also talked about gaining trust for a while. Like, that was really difficult, and how... You know, some work was brought in, but it took you a long time. And the show was up, people were like, okay, now we trust you.
Yeah, right? So there were people. My brother had been in the industry for 25 years. I had been in it for 15 years. And there were people that were like, this is my favorite record. I don't want you putting it on the wall. Someone might take it. And furthermore, no one's ever done this before. So why are you really putting up an exhibit of hip-hop memorabilia or artifacts? And these are like gold plaques. There were stuff that didn't come in because they were people, they were one of a kind, right? So people that have won contests around the world, you know, they have these expensive trophies or whatever, and they just didn't arrive, right? And that really comes back to this whole idea of exploitation, right? And the marginalized communities in which are used to being exploited, right, or taken advantage of in a way. So I wouldn't have been able to do this had I not had a community hip-hop radio show. Even if I had that, I wouldn't have had the same access if I didn't have an older brother who was peers with, you know, peers with the maestros and mishimis and these sort of things to gain that access to do the work, because there was... there's just no trust there because people know that it's not valued by the rest of society. So you must be doing something malicious with this.
Right? Has some of it now gone into a permanent collection, or is it reprivatized?
No, I mean, it's all reprivatized. A lot of people have been, and this is what you don't know, people have always remembered Toronto Free Gallery now as this very avant-garde space. It's like, you mean the hip-hop exhibit's not there anymore? I thought it was permanent. I mean, Toronto Free is the only place that would allow.
Has it bought the collection?
With what money? I can barely pay myself.
And the whole interesting thing about the comment is that the people that would want their things in here, in a permanent collection, the idea of being paid for it isn't even on the table. The recognition is so highly sought that the idea of being paid is not even on the table. You know, for people that actually want to contribute things. And I think that's the piece where people might come tonight to the exhibit and be like, oh, this is not Toronto Free Gallery. Because there was a real sense of community that there were 22-year-olds that were there on opening night. First of all, opening night must have had 380 people. Like,
we have about 1,800 to 2,000 square feet, and you could not move.
Yeah.
And good thing the fire department didn't come down, because that we didn't even... We're like, whatever. You couldn't move.
So at the end of the opening night, a 22-year-old came up to me and said, oh, now I get it. This is what you called hip-hop. This was community. This is people getting along. This is creativity. This is competitiveness. This is creation. And he had this whole puzzled look on his face, and he was the photographer for the night. And then when the headliner started performing the last song, he's like, oh, now I get it. Because none of these artists are on the radio. None of these people are selling millions of records. And they're standing beside me, and we're having a conversation about whatever. And it was like an aha moment for someone that didn't grow up in my generation.
So a question and a comment too. First off, I think I want to express my deep thanks for you guys for putting this on, for Heather, you know, hosting it in Toronto Free, and then Mark organizing it. Because when I went down there with my partner to see it, and it was later, it was just, you know, a couple of weeks before it was done. I just you know, going around the room and seeing different artifacts and listening, you know, you get the listening stations. I started to get like kind of teary eyed, right? And my partner, you know, hit me in my arms, like, what's wrong with you? And I was thinking about it after. I was like, why was I so emotional? Why did I have such a kind of visceral kind of reaction to this stuff? And at first, I thought it was just kind of corny nostalgia, but then when I thought about it more and when I discussed it with my partner, it was like, because it was seeing a part of yourself and a part of your history, you know, like growing up in Meadowvale and being involved in hip-hop, going to parties at Meadowvale Community Center where Wayne Williams, you know, kind of went on to bigger things at Flow, was DJing and like breakdancing and just being involved in the culture, seeing a part of your history and yourself kind of validated in public space. And that's why, and I hadn't experienced that, you know, with that hip hop side of me before, and so it was very moving for me. But the question I have was to do with accessibility and marginalization of the culture, with the recent developments at Flow, and what's that, and there was such a struggle to get Flow on the air, and for Flow the station, the 93.5, to be a certain way, to be what it was. And now, I mean, it was a black-owned station, Denim Jolly, black entrepreneur. And then it being basically just dismantled in a space of a week with kind of no warning, and all the Toronto hip-hop that was on there, the shows that had started on community radio and you know, that got a slot on Flow, and some of the programming that went on, and just the voices that you heard on there. And now Flow has been... I mean, it's totally changed. So you have this kind of weird kind of movement, and you have CBC, eventually, finally, the doors being knocked down at CBC to open up. At the same time, Flow has been destroyed. So I don't know, Mark or Heather, if you both want to address, but how do you explain that? You know, this little moment in Toronto hip-hop history, which just seems to be such a, kind of a sad, but at the same time, a joyous moment in terms of CBC finally opening up in a way, and
I think in terms of accessibility and marginalization, like just thinking about Flow and CKLN in the same week, right? We had Flow and CKLN in the same week, and then having the CBC, like we were working on the CBC thing the whole time. I think it's a testament. And I could speak on this because I've been in college radio for so long, but it's a testament to the resiliency that the culture can facilitate, right? So when one door is knocked down, you know, another community radio station host might end up on CBC or something like that. So I think it speaks well of 12 years it took to make Flow possible, right? 10 years to destroy it, but at the same moment in time, we're also building, right? We're building with T.Dot Pioneers. Northside Hip Hop is an online archive that I created, and this was not even part of the presentation, but the big win that this entire exhibition was the launch party for northsidehiphop.ca, which I didn't mention in the talk and I completely forgot, but northsidehiphop.ca is an online archive where I've taken everything from the exhibit and put it online digitally. And that was funded by Canadian Heritage. And that was the first big win to convince the people at Canadian Heritage that hip-hop culture is a culture worthy of being funded and valued in that way, right? So, and that, and these kinds of skills, right, to knock on these doors and to articulate in the fashion that you can articulate hip-hop culture in is really something that came out of just being part of hip-hop. You know what I mean? It's the resiliency that is built within the creative industries of hip-hop, because a lot of those, like in that encasement, those are all trophies from Turnstiles, which is a DJ crew, and one of the DJs, he trained me here at CHRY. He would literally train 6 hours a day on his turntables, right? And that is a different level of discipline that you don't, he's not getting paid to do that, and it's not being validated anywhere. He's not going to school and getting an A for DJ. There's no DJ school in 96 in Toronto, and he's spending 6 hours each evening on his turntables, learning how to play it like an instrument, right? And that's the kind of sort of discipline and resiliency, I think, allows hip-hop culture to continue to sort of move into spaces that it hasn't been in. Like, as we speak, Ryerson, kids at Ryerson are knocking down the doors, trying to get a course on hip-hop, right? and they're not me. They're not the ones that have been in hip-hop for 15, 20 years. So, wherever a door closes, you know, another one gets open.
And I mean, I was just one thing. It's more with the documentary film world, but something kind of similar happened where you had the documentary channel, and there was a bit of a shady takeover with CBC Television, and it became documentary. And at the time, the documentary channel was supporting documentary filmmakers across Canada. You could make a documentary and you could go to them, and 9 times out of 10 they would buy it anywhere from like a whopping $2,000 to like $20,000 depending. So you knew you had a home. And then when it was taken over by CBC, it just melted. And that move kind of really killed Toronto documentary filmmaker, or Canadian documentary filmmakers getting access. So, you know, I don't know how similar that is, but, you know, I think within that CBC machine, you know, there's always that, you know, like they want to own it, but they don't know what to do with it, you know, and so it just kind of falls into the void of bureaucracy,
right,
and nothingness, you know.
Right.
So
I wonder, though, I mean, you know, I have a 23-year-old son, right, who grew up in the beaches, and he's obviously white. But he and his buddies, they know the whole lexicon and the whole cultural, you know, metaphorics of hip-hop. Where would they get it from? I mean, what are the channels through which a kid in the beaches has access to it? What are the channels of communication? That's what I was earlier asking about space. Where is it at? Where is stuff happening? But how, if it's not, we know now it's not the CBC. We know the radio station, the college station have been under pressure. What are the channels of communication that it travels into the high schools? Because if you go into a high school, I go to a lot of high schools, when you're in high schools, to look at high schools for my son and now my daughter, the way they present culture in high school, you will always see a hip-hop act. Right? You will always see that the high school represents itself to be out there, and the kids represent themselves. So how does hip-hop travel through the city, but it's not through the radio stations and not through the typical cultural institutions?
Do you want me to answer this? Here, let me do this.
How does it travel?
Because I know you can't speak anymore.
The internet right now is probably where the kids in the suburb access hip-hop, because we know more times than not they're not actually going into the places where hip-hop is created. But post sort of the HMV, the CD, a lot of people are just finding information on the internet, and it's not hard. Hip hop is everywhere now. Mm-hmm. Right, the Toronto Blue Jays have a breakdancing crew. the Blue Jay Breakers when, you know, breakdancing was outlawed in 82 or 86 or something like that. So hip-hop's everywhere, and kids have access to it everywhere.
I mean, you know, I grew up in Houston, Texas, in, like, the really scary suburbs, and that, you know, in the early 80s, you know, when I wanted to go find it, I would go, and there wasn't internet back then. It's so weird to think about that, but, you know, we would go downtown, and, you know, we would just go through record store after record store. Huh?
An arcade fire song is about you.
What arcade?
There's an arcade fire song about kids in Houston who go downtown and see the modern kids.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't heard that song.
That song.
That's hilarious.
Go downtown
I don't know.
To see the modern kids.
Oh, I have to look that up. Yeah, I don't know that song.
Sorry.
No, but I mean, you know, you just find it. You go for it. I mean, you know, I was living in a world of, like, Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders and horrible, scary football jocks, and, you know, I had to get out and find, you know, something. So you just find ways to find it if you need it, you know.
Maybe just to follow up on this, I mean, in the lead up to the concert, they did a kind of little audio documentary on Club 65. Talked about him being a kid in Halifax forever, and, you know, talking earlier about this idea of practicing scratching, and so part of this radio documentary is about him as a little kid hiding in his room, scratching by himself, because nobody in anywhere in the vicinity of where he was living had any idea what this was about, or what he was talking about, or anything. So this, I was very interested in that moment, him sort of emerging as this kind of singular individual into a kind of hip-hop aficionado, as it were, and then developing his own style, because, I mean, you listen to his, what he calls hip-hop, I don't know if I would call it hip-hop, but it sounds a bit experimental to me in a certain way, which, you know, is kind of appealing to my ear. But the question I want to ask, I want to go back. Mark was talking about the work on the textbook, and now there's a textbook in the schools that has a chapter or something. So, what is that textbook? And I was just trying to think, like, would in at, you know, I know there was a kind of big meeting at one of the high schools the other day about Afrocentric school and high school. So would hip-hop have a place in the study of the Afrocentric curriculum? I mean, would an exhibition like this be inside or outside, accessible or inaccessible to a kind of Afrocentric pedagogical formation within the school system? Is this sort of something that stands in opposition to that movement, or is it something that may in fact be embraced? You know, where does hip-hop stand in relationship to the various tendencies, artistic or political or otherwise, that seem to be percolating within the community? I mean, so I guess I'm asking, what is there a way, I mean, this is very celebratory, but how do we get to a kind of critical discussion about where hip-hop is in relationship to other moments of fragmentation, perhaps, within the urban.
Sorry, I didn't realize the time, so this would be a last, my last question.
Well, sorry. We could go. We could stay here.
I know. I'd like to.
I didn't
want
to say anything because I want to go to the. I want to go down to Park.
Yeah, you
want to
get there. You got to get there in time.
So you're asking, where is an exhibit like this? What's its role in, say, now?
Yeah, I mean,
a
curriculum or something like that.
Well, the classes that I brought down, one was an English class, and one was the African-Canadian course. And I think it's because it's in the textbook, I use it as a piece to sort of bring the textbook alive, right? That textbook now is in Halifax and in Toronto being taught, and in Brampton, in, you know, just outside the GTA, it's being taught. So it's very much accessible for the kids because it's media, it's social, you know, it's ways and it's multimedia. So there's audio components, there's visuals, and the kids can use it as a learning device, right? In terms of Afrocentric curriculum, there's a huge piece on the griot here, right? There's a huge piece on oral tradition, and that is directly and uniquely Afrocentric, right? So it most definitely should, to me, I mean, this is one of the arguments, this exhibit should be an argument for the Toronto Museum. When they finally get the Toronto Museum, there should be something in there on Toronto's hip-hop culture that's a permanent collection. It probably will never happen, but it would be an excellent teaching tool. And one of the things that, I think if it was not part of the Afrocentric curriculum, it actually might have a greater impact. Because we have tons of teachers out there that will not engage in any of that discourse at all, and think of it as segregation, right? So if it wasn't in a Canadian social studies textbook, then, you know, we might be able to make more headway.
On that note, thank you guys, Heather, Mark, for an excellent presentation and for dropping all this knowledge on us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And sorry for the technical difficulties. But since you're from your
I'm using
it.